Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The idea that an 18-year-old can walk into a store and buy weapons of war designed and marketed to kill is, I think, just wrong. It just violates common sense.
President Biden plans to visit Uvalde, Texas, after an 18-year-old gunman shot dead 19 students and two teachers in a fourth-grade classroom. It was the deadliest school shooting in over a decade. We'll speak to the gun control group Giffords, named after Congressmember Gabby Giffords, the victim of another mass shooting. We will also speak to an Australian gun activist who helped rewrite Australia's gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre. Plus, we'll look at more at the Texas community of Uvalde and the role of Border Patrol in the region.
DHS has so far said that they won't enforce immigration law in Uvalde for the time being. But of course, we have no idea what that means moving forward.
And we speak to Patrick Coburn about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He warns London and Washington are being propelled by hubris, just as Putin was. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vigils were held in Uvalde, Texas, Wednesday, a day after an 18-year-old gunman shot and killed 19 students and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. It was the deadliest school shooting in the United States in over a decade. All the victims were in the same fourth-grade class. The White House says President Biden will visit Uvalde in the coming days. Meanwhile, chilling details have emerged about the events leading up to the massacre. Officials say the gunman lawfully purchased two semi-automatic assault rifles and up to 375 rounds of ammunition just last week after his 18th birthday. On Tuesday morning, he texted a teenage girl he'd befriended online in Germany, writing, "I'm going to shoot my grandmother." Then he wrote, "I just shot my grandma in her head," followed immediately by the message, "I'm a go shoot up a elementary school." Police say the gunman shot his way past an armed school security officer, then barricaded himself inside the school for over an hour, wounding two police officers before he was shot dead by a Border Patrol agent. Some parents report they tried to storm the school as they waited for police to respond, but were pushed back. The gunman was reportedly in that school between 40 minutes and an hour. On Wednesday, Texas gubernatorial candidate and former Democratic Congressmember Beto O'Rourke interrupted a press conference held by Texas Governor Greg Abbott in Uvalde. Video of the incident shows Beto approaching the stage and telling Abbott, "This is totally predictable when you choose not to do anything." Beto O'Rourke was shouted down by top Texas Republicans and escorted from the room by police. We'll play excerpts of that confrontation after headlines. Governor Abbott has declined to say whether he still plans to attend the National Rifle Association's 2022 annual meeting, which is set to open in Houston on Friday. Texas Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Republican Senator Ted Cruz still plan to attend, as does former President Donald Trump. He'll be the headliner on Friday night. World leaders continue to react in horror to the latest mass shooting in the United States. At the Vatican, Pope Francis said Wednesday he's heartbroken by the massacre in Texas.
It is time to say enough to the indiscriminate trafficking of weapons. Let us all make a commitment. Let us all make a commitment so that tragedies like this cannot happen again.
After headlines, we'll get the latest on the Texas elementary school massacre and speak with a gun activist who helped rewrite Australia's gun laws after a mass shooting in 1996. In Ukraine, fierce fighting continues to rage around the besieged industrial city of Severodonetsk, where sustained Russian artillery attacks this week have killed at least six civilians. Russian forces are also advancing on the city of Lyman in the southeastern Donetsk region. On Wednesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky blasted Henry Kissinger after the former U.S. Secretary of State said Ukraine should trade some of its territory for a peace agreement with Russia. Zelensky compared Kissinger's proposal to the appeasement of Nazi Germany in the 1930s.
Mr. Kissinger emerges from the deep past and says that a piece of Ukraine should be given to Russia so that there is no alienation of Russia from Europe. It seems that Mr. Kissinger's calendar is not 2022, but 1938. And he thought he was talking to an audience, not in Davos, but in Munich of that time.
Russia's parliament has voted to abolish an upper age limit for people wishing to join the military. Once President Vladimir Putin signs the measure into law, Russians over the age of 40 will be able to enlist in the armed forces. On Wednesday, Putin visited a military hospital in Moscow, where he met with soldiers injured in Ukraine for the first time since he ordered his troops to invade more than 3 months ago. Also Wednesday, Putin signed a decree fast-tracking Russian citizenship for residents of Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine. Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has extended emergency powers, citing the war in neighboring Ukraine. The move grants Orbán's far-right nationalist government sweeping powers to enact policies without the input of the legislature. Orbán, who recently won a fourth term as prime minister, has been accused of turning Hungary into a, quote, ballot box dictatorship. In Afghanistan, at least 14 people were killed in a series of bomb attacks Wednesday. Five people died and 22 others injured after a bomb exploded in a mosque during evening prayers in the capital, Kabul. Meanwhile, in northern Afghanistan, nine people were killed and 15 others injured in a series of blasts targeting minivans carrying minority Shia Muslims in the city of Mazar-e Sharif. Afghanistan's ISIS affiliate claimed responsibility for those attacks. The violence came as UNICEF warned some 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Thousands of people across the Middle East have been hospitalized with respiratory problems after a massive sandstorm settled over the region this week. Kuwait suspended airline flights. Iran canceled classes for school children. Saudi officials warned drivers over zero visibility conditions on roads. On Monday, Iraq's government canceled most public services as the country's ninth major sandstorm in less than 2 months arrived. The United Nations Environment Program says Iraq is one of the most vulnerable nations to climate change and desertification. In Pakistan, temperatures in the city of Jacobabad hit a record 51 degrees Celsius Wednesday. That's 124 degrees Fahrenheit. Farmers in the region say extreme heat this year is killing crops and drying up water supplies.
The mango crop yield has been reduced by 50% this year. This is because of the scarcity of water. Mango farmers have suffered losses, and so did the traders.
The Biden administration says it'll seek to ban the disposal of mining waste in Alaska's Bristol Bay, citing its authority under the Clear Water Act, the Clean Water Act. The move by the Environmental Protection Agency could spell the end of the Pebble Mine project, a proposed open-pit gold and copper mine that would require constructing a massive power plant, natural gas pipeline, and huge toxic tailing ponds. In Davos, Switzerland, climate activists on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum are demanding world leaders act urgently on the climate and on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This is Kenyan environmentalist Elizabeth Wathuti.
I think one of the main things about the war in Ukraine is the fact that it has continued to exacerbate the impacts of climate change, and especially the rising food insecurity in the Horn of Africa. And what we're hearing is the fact that, you know, this crisis, people talk about it, but we are not talking about the Ukraine crisis and the climate crisis at the same time. And it's as though people are not aware of the fact that this crisis also continues to impact the communities on the front line.
In Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, at least 23 people have been killed in one of the deadliest police operations in the nation's modern history. The police raid targeted Vila Cruzeiro, one of the Rio's favelas, historically low-income communities that trace their origin to the legacy of slavery and the system of racial oppression in Brazil that continues to this day. Officials say military police were dispatched early Tuesday to capture leaders of a suspected drug trafficking group when gunfire erupted. Witnesses say police arrived shooting to kill. One resident, a 41-year-old woman, died after she was struck by a stray bullet. Dora Greja Gomes, a professor and leader of the Federation of Rio de Janeiro's Favelas, spoke just after the killings.
Regardless of whether a person was involved in a crime, if it's proven these were executions, well, no one should have been executed. There is no death penalty in Brazil, right? So I think we need to carry out a very serious and very rigorous investigation to understand how these murders took place.
Here in the United States, President Biden marked the second anniversary of George Floyd's murder by signing an executive order aimed at reforming policing. Joining Biden at Wednesday's signing ceremony was George Floyd's family, as well as that of Breonna Taylor, who was killed in 2020 when police executed a no-knock warrant at her apartment.
This is a call to action based on a basic truth. Public trust, as any cop will tell you, is the foundation of public safety. If they're not trusted, the population doesn't contribute, doesn't cooperate.
Biden's order directs federal agencies to revise use-of-force policies, banning tactics like chokeholds and restricting practices like no-knock warrants while establishing a national database of police misconduct. Biden's executive order came as a reform bill. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act remains stalled in the Senate amidst Republican opposition. And the Goldman Environmental Foundation held its annual awards ceremony Wednesday, honoring the world's foremost grassroots environmental activists. This year's winners include Nigeria's Chima Williams, an environmental lawyer who worked with communities to hold Royal Dutch Shell accountable for the environmental impact of its oil spills in Nigeria. Other winners include Ecuador's Alexandra Narvaez and Alex Lusitante, who together spearhead an indigenous movement to protect Cofan ancestral territory from gold mining. Also winning a Goldman Award this year was Nayeli Kobo of Los Angeles, California, who in March 2020, at the age of 19, led a community coalition to permanently shut down an oil drilling site in her community. Kobo survived childhood asthma and a bout of cancer she blamed on toxins from the oil wells.
What formally began in January 2011 as a grassroots campaign in South Los Angeles, fighting the oil well next door, operating on land owned by the Archdiocese, ends in January 2022, with the City of Los Angeles voting unanimously to phase out oil and gas wells. We won't stop here. We need to ensure our elected officials act on this. I fight because I believe everyone has a right to breathe clean air despite age, gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, or zip code. I fight so no future generations has a childhood like mine.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Vigils were held in Uvalde, Texas, Wednesday, a day after an 18-year-old gunman shot dead 19 students and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. It was the deadliest school shooting in the United States in a decade. All the victims were in the same fourth grade classroom. On Wednesday, CNN's Anderson Cooper interviewed Angel Garza, whose 10-year-old daughter, Amari Jo Garza, died in the attack.
I'm a med aide, so when I arrived on the scene, they still had kids inside. They started bringing the kids out, and I was aiding assistants. One little girl was just covered in blood, head to toe. Like, I thought she was injured. I asked her what was wrong, and she said she's okay. She was hysterical, saying that they shot her best friend, that they killed her best friend, and she's not breathing, and that she was trying to call the cops. And I asked the little girl the name, and she's... And she told me, and she said, Amory. She just turned 10. Her birthday was on the 10th, May the 10th, 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. You had a party for her.
We just gathered a family and had a dinner. She just got her phone. She had been wanting a phone for so long, and we finally got it for her. She just tried to call the police.
She actually tried to call.
Yes, I got confirmation from two of the students in her classroom that she was just trying to call the authorities. And I guess he just shot her. How do you look at this girl and shoot her? Oh, my baby. How do you shoot my baby? Oh, I'm sorry.
Those are the words of Angel Garza, father of Amari Jo Garza, who was shot dead in her fourth grade classroom in Uvalde, along with 18 classmates and two teachers. Amari's just 10 years old. As mourning continues across the nation, Republicans are facing increasing criticism for opposing any new gun control measures. On Wednesday, Democratic Texas gubernatorial candidate, former Congressmember Beto O'Rourke, interrupted a news conference held in Uvalde by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Listen closely.
I will pass the mic to Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick.
Governor Abbott. Excuse me.
Sit down.
You're out of line and an embarrassment.
Sit down.
The next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing.
No, you need to get his ass out of here. This isn't the place to talk this over.
This is totally predictable. When you,
sir, you're out of line. Sir, you're out of line. Sir, you're out of line. Please leave this auditorium.
After Beto O'Rourke, the former presidential candidate and congressman, was escorted out of the Uvalde High School auditorium where the press conference was held, he spoke to reporters.
Because the governor of the state of Texas, the most powerful man in the state, chose to do nothing. He went to Santa Fe High School after kids were killed in their classrooms, told the parents he would do something. He did nothing. He came to my hometown of El Paso after 23 people were slaughtered. He said he was going to do something. He did nothing. In fact, the only thing he did was make it easier to buy a gun. The only thing he did was make it easier to carry a gun in public. And he bragged about the fact that there would be no background check, no training, no vetting whatsoever.
That was Texas gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke speaking in Uvalde on Wednesday. President Biden's expected to visit the town in the coming days. To look more at the gun crisis in America, we're joined by Robin Lloyd, managing director of Giffords, a gun violence prevention organization led by former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who in 2011 survived being shot in the head by a gunman who killed six people and injured 12 others at a constituent event in a parking lot in Tucson, Arizona. And has since become a leading gun control advocate. Robin Lloyd, welcome to Democracy Now! First, your response to what took place and the fact that the U.S. is alone in the world for these mass shootings in schools or other places. The fact that of every 100 people in this country, there are 120 guns, more civilian guns in this country than people. There's nothing like this anywhere in the world. If you can talk about this.
I completely agree. This is a uniquely American problem, and it's happening with such frequency and such devastation. It's almost hard to wrap your mind around. As you know, the tragedy in Uvalde on Tuesday was the third deadliest school shooting in this country, second or third only to Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting and the Virginia Tech shooting. It's also the fourth deadliest shooting in Texas, of the most deadliest shootings in recent history in this country. 4 out of 10 have occurred in Texas in recent years. So there's definitely something specific to the United States and our lack of strong gun laws and our patchwork of gun laws that we have across different states that allow this to keep happening, in addition to the sheer number of firearms that exist in this country and how easy it is to access them.
Robin, could you explain why is it so easy to access guns in the U.S.? And also, who are the weapons manufacturers? Who is manufacturing these almost 400 million guns that are in civilian hands in the U.S.?
So here in the United States, we don't have strong gun laws at the federal level. There's very few updates to federal gun regulation in the past 20 plus years. The last kind of significant push occurred in the early 1990s. At the state level, it's a different story. Some states like New York have very strong gun laws, but they are still susceptible to the lax gun laws of their neighbors. And it's very easy for firearms to travel across state lines and to get into the hands of those that shouldn't have them. Other states like Texas have virtually no strong gun laws. Texas, unfortunately, at the Giffords Law Center, we give a letter grade rating to every state in the country. Texas has an F, which is probably not very surprising. But as you heard in the clip from Beto O'Rourke earlier, all Texas has done in recent years, despite the tragic shootings that have occurred, El Paso, Sutherland Springs, Odessa, just to name a few, they've only rolled back gun laws, and they've actually made it easier to carry concealed weapons. No questions asked, no training, no permits, no requirements whatsoever for anybody to carry a concealed firearm in Texas. So that's all they've done in recent years. They've made it easier to do that. And really, this is by design. The American gun lobby, which is supported by American gun manufacturers, is alive and well. The National Rifle Association, the NRA, has been weakened due to self-inflicted wounds of greed and mismanagement of funds. But other organizations like the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is the lobbying arm for the gun industry and gun retailers, is alive and well. And actually, the National Shooting Sports Foundation spends more on lobbying against gun violence prevention measures here in Washington than the NRA does. So they're the true face of the American corporate gun lobby. And quite frankly, there's a lot of money at stake. There has been an incredible surge of gun sales in the past decade, largely driven by fear and conspiracy promulgated by the corporate gun lobby here in the United States. And that has meant an incredible increase in their bottom line.
Robin, could you explain how exactly this works? I mean, these gun manufacturers, do they fund these lobbyists who subsequently give money and funding to politicians? Or is it possible for corporations to directly engage with politicians? Because just the scale of the problem, the fact that 90% of Americans support minimal restraints, background checks, and yet that's not occurred. So the scale of the problem seems enormous. What needs to be done also seems obvious, and yet nothing happens.
Nermeen, you hit the nail on the head. It's an incredible, concentrated, historic lobbying effort by the corporate gun lobby. So manufacturers, other companies affiliated with the firearms industry, they pay into these trade associations, and then those trade associations represent their viewpoint in Washington and in state capitals all across the country. And again, the NRA has historically been the primary figure in that, but really the National Shooting Sports Foundation, NSSF, has really taken up the mantle in recent years and is self-proclaimed the new face of the American gun industry. But you're right, the overwhelming majority of Americans, and I'm not talking about a majority, I'm talking about a super majority, you know, 85, 90, 95% plus people support doing something to address gun violence in this country by supporting meaningful gun safety measures, something like a background check on every gun sale. That has been politicized over the past several years, but really what it is saying that no matter how you buy a gun, whether it's at a gun dealer, whether it's at a gun show, whether it's online, whether it's meeting somebody in a parking lot, you have to have a background check. And right now that does not exist in this country. It is left up to the states. And thus we have a patchwork of laws that make it very easy for criminals and other people who cannot pass a background check to get their hands on a firearm. So there are very clear things that we can do to make our country safer. But we need to have our elected leaders to have the political will and the courage to make that happen.
Why does it take political will and courage, Robin Lloyd, when the overwhelming number of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, support gun control? This is the part that's so hard to understand, also with the NRA at its lowest ebb and facing all these corruption charges, etc. I mean, again, Pew Research Center, support creating a federal gun database to track gun sales. Overall, more than two-thirds of people in this country support this. Supporting banning high-capacity ammunition magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Overall, 64% of Americans support this, 83% Democrats and Republicans. You have support banning assault-style weapons, 83% of Republicans, of Democrats, a third of Republicans, overall 63%. How is it that the elected leaders can go against the electorate every single year?
You're absolutely right. If we were talking about those numbers for any other issue area, it already would have happened. The fact that we're talking about something that only has 66% of the American public supporting it versus 90% of some of our other issues like background checks is really incredible. But the fact of the matter is there's a tremendous amount of money at stake. The gun lobby is in the business of selling more guns, period. And that impacts their bottom line. That's how they make their money. And they have hoodwinked American politicians and some members of the public into believing that the only way that we can protect ourselves is to arm ourselves. And that's an absolute lie. It's a strategy based on fear, but it is a lie. More guns do not make us safer. In fact, they make us far less safe, as we see play out time and time again in this country on a day-to-day basis, to say nothing of the recent tragedies in Buffalo, New York and Uvalde, Texas on the past 10 days alone.
Robin, could you speak specifically about the issues surrounding assault weapons, assault rifles? Because you pointed out earlier that there's more that's been done at the state level than at the federal level. 400 pieces of legislation signed into law in states since the 2012 massacre at Sandy Hook. And yet only 8 states have bans on assault weapons. So could you explain why that's the case?
Absolutely. So the proliferation of assault weapons in this country is a relatively new phenomenon. It's something that's happened really in recent years, because there was a federal assault weapons ban that went into effect in 1994, but it sunset in 2004. So this has been relatively recently that we've seen the proliferation of assault weapons. In absence of a federal ban, States have taken up the charge. And as you noted, seven states in the District of Columbia currently ban assault weapons. But in many other places, you know, the horse is out of the barn, so to speak. There are so many assault weapons in this country. It seems like it might be hard to address what to do with them now. And I think there's varying degrees. There are various proposals that can address that. It certainly can be done. But there is a reality that we have so many assault weapons already in circulation. And I think there is some reluctance by politicians, whether they should have it or not, to do more. But we absolutely can do more on assault weapons. I want to be very, very clear. But it is absolutely driven by marketing, again, by the gun lobby. This is a way for them to, you know, kind of, quote, militarize civilians. If you see some of their marketing campaigns, they use phrases like, it's time to get your man card. And they show somebody who's a civilian, but almost as, you know, dressed as a soldier or a law enforcement person in tactical gear with an assault weapon. And they've really made it seem like it's, quote, the cool thing to do. But the reality is that assault weapons are incredibly deadly. They are designed to kill as many people as possible in a short amount of time, given their firepower, their accuracy, and of course the ability to accept extended magazines.
Robin Lloyd, I want to thank you for being with us, Managing Director of Giffords, the Gun Violence Prevention Organization. When we come back, we're going to talk to an Australian gun activist. Australia, a country of gun lovers. How, over a series of days after a massacre that took place several decades ago, did it have a complete paradigm shift and change all of its laws? Stay with it. Guns have caused too much pain. This town will never be the same. So, for the bands of Dunblane, we ask, please, never again. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me down to lie in pastures green. He leadeth me. The quiet waters by. That's a rendition of Bob Dylan's Knockin' on Heaven's Door by the Scottish musician Ted Christopher, a tribute to the 1996 Dunblane primary school shooting in Scotland when a gunman shot dead 16 children ages 5 and 6 and a teacher. It was the deadliest mass shooting in UK history. After the shooting, the UK changed its gun laws. There hasn't been a school shooting there since. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we continue to look at the school shooting massacre in Uvalde, Texas, we're joined by Rebecca Peters, international arms control advocate, former director of the International Action Network on Small Arms. She led the campaign to reform Australia's gun laws after the 1996 Port Arthur massacre, when a gunman shot dead 35 people at a cafe. After the attack, Australia cracked down on gun violence, outlawing automatic and semi-automatic rifles. More than 640,000 weapons were turned into authorities in a nationwide buyback. Rebecca Peters is joining us from Guatemala. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us again. I feel like we keep having you back after all of these massacres, but it is so important because there was a complete paradigm shift in Australia, a country where so many didn't think it was possible. Talk about what happened in 1996, the horror of the Port Arthur massacre, but then how the country responded.
Well, thanks, Amy. Yes, I mean, thinking back, we had back then, we had a situation. It was similar, but not as bad, of course, as in the United States, which is that we did have We had mass shootings about once a year. We had some kind of a mass shooting, and semi-automatic rifles were available in some states. The laws vary state by state in Australia, as in America. And we also had a similar sort of standoff where both of the major political parties were intimidated by the gun lobby, which said, whichever one of you moves to strengthen the gun laws, we will come after you in the election. And so it was a similar kind of scenario in that way, although we never had the very high rates of gun violence, not as high, because we did have our basic level of gun control was higher. What happened in 1996 was this massacre was so enormous, and it took place in a tourist location where a lot of people have been for holidays or for honeymoons, and people, because it was a tourist location, the victims came from every state and territory in the nation. And so every parliament had a constituent or two or more who were affected directly by this massacre. And we had just had a new Conservative prime minister elected. And so he had, I guess he saw that he had a few years ahead of him before he had to face another election. And also, I mean, it was just enough. Enough was enough. We'd had too much of this. And what he was able to do was he called the states and territories together and said, I'm going to fix this. And what the amazing breakthrough was that both political parties agreed to support the changes. And that left the gun lobby with nowhere to go. And so very quickly, also the research, the policy recommendations, it had already been done by us in civil society, by research institutions. I mean, it was pretty clear what the changes were that were needed. And in 10 days, we got an agreement that all the states and territories would change their laws to a much higher standard. And they did. And so that meant outlawing semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, a much higher standard of background checks and licensing that was required, including the proof of a legitimate reason to have the sort of gun you want to buy, at registration of all firearms, so that if someone has displayed some kind of behavior that suggests they shouldn't have a firearm, that firearm can be taken away, and also so that you can track the accumulation of arsenals. And a range of other things as well. But basically, the laws became pretty much uniform across the country. And as part of, as you mentioned earlier, as part of that, the ban on semi-automatics, those guns were bought back, so they're no longer in circulation. And because the law changed at the same time, there are buybacks, but the law doesn't change. So it's kind of like just mopping the floor while the tap is still on. If you change the law at the same time, then those guns cannot be immediately replaced with similar weapons. And so, and really the result has been a spectacular success. We didn't have another mass shooting incident for almost 25 years, and we just generally have much lower rates of gun violence and also a lower rate of fear. You know, we don't think at all about the possibility of being murdered as we go about our daily lives in Australia.
Rebecca, a couple of things that might be, apart from the fact, as you mentioned, that Australia, even prior to these changes, had much fewer mass shootings than the U.S. Could you talk about the relative strength of the gun lobby there, whether the electoral system in Australia is so dependent on funding from lobbyists and corporations, number one? And then second, that Australia, of course, had nothing like the Second Amendment. There's no constitutional right in Australia to bear arms. And what impact that might have had?
Yes, that's right. So, we never had the idea in. Well, there are Australians who believe that it is a right to have a gun, but that was never legally acceptable or even socially acceptable, really. And in fact, with the new laws, they actually, most of them say really specifically, ownership of guns is a privilege that is subject to the overriding concern for public safety. So that's really clear that public safety trumps individual ownership of weapons. And that was a huge advantage we had, of course. And also, as you mentioned, it's true. We had a gun lobby that was cranky and threatening and had succeeded in some cases in intimidating or in probably contributing to the defeat of some electoral candidates. But they did not have the power that the American gun lobby has, because our electoral system, well, we have a parliamentary system, but also the role of money in politics. Although we still complain in Australia that there's too much money in politics, certainly the ability to so kind of outright just buy the politicians and the policies you want is much less in Australia. It's true that we had those distinct advantages before this all took place.
Rebecca, very quickly, we have less than a minute, but if you can talk about how the U.S. exports this violence around the world, the U.S. being by far the largest small arms exporter in the world.
Yes, I mean, the U.S. is the largest producer, the largest exporter, both illegal and legal. So when we talk about exports, you often think of legal exports of weapons. But of course, the trafficking of guns from the U.S., because of the loose regulation, especially of the southern border states, means that the U.S. is also the biggest exporter of illegal weapons. And that means that the violence problems that occur, especially in Latin America, are very directly traceable in large part to the American production of weapons and of violence. And so it's why all of us in the rest of the world have a big interest in America doing something about its just unbelievably lax regulation of weapons.
Rebecca Peters, I want to thank you for being with us, international arms control advocate, former director of the International Action Network on Small Arms, led the campaign to reform Australia's gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre. She's speaking to us from Guatemala. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Tuesday's mass shooting at an elementary school took place in the small South Texas city of Uvalde. 90% of Robb Elementary School students are Latinx. The area is also heavily militarized border zone in South Texas. Officials say it was a member of the Border Patrol's tactical unit known as BORTAC who shot and killed the shooter. This is CBP Del Rio Sector Chief Jason Owens.
My men and women that work at the Uvalde station, this is their home. They had children that go to this school. You know, so anytime a call like this goes out, it's all hands on deck. They're going to respond, but even more so when it impacts their home like this did. We did have over 80 Border Patrol agents from the Uvalde station, from Brackettville, from the Special Operations Detachment, and all points in between. Some came from off-duty. Some came from training, and they all responded. So collaboratively, everybody came together. We did have a contingent of our BORTAC team that helped DPS and other police departments make entry and actually confront the suspect and ultimately bring this to a conclusion.
Some of the parents who came to find their children at the school after the massacre were from mixed immigration status families, and Department of Homeland Security issued a statement. This is after a lot of people were calling for this, calling Uvalde, Texas, a protected area, and said, quote, to the fullest extent possible, it would not conduct immigration enforcement activities there. This comes after ICE deported a woman who survived the 2019 El Paso massacre that targeted Latinx people and killed 23, even after she reportedly helped prosecutors in their case against the shooter. They deported her. Well, for more, we're joined by Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, who was born and raised in McAllen, Texas, about a four-hour drive to Uvalde, and has been following this closely. He's the author of Crimmigration Law and Migrating to Prison, America's Obsession with Locking Up Immigrants. Welcome to Democracy Now! The horror of what took place in Uvalde, a place that you are very familiar with, Cesar, and the fact that people started calling for this immediately, you've got to say that ICE is not going to pick people up if parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles go looking for their kids. They're not going to check their immigration status. And then the federal government did issue this yesterday. But talk about the issue larger. Of course, it's also a community of Latinx population that has lived there for decades.
Yeah, I was glad to see that the Department of Homeland Security did issue that statement, but I hope that the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol agents specifically who are on the ground there in the Valle are being much more proactive than simply relying on a press release, a three-paragraph press release published on the DHS website. I hope no one's expecting that the families and community members who are directly affected by this latest massacre in the United States are tuning into the DHS website. And so it's really incumbent on the leadership in the Uvalde Border Patrol Station. This is a community that has a Border Patrol Station in town. And so I'm not surprised to learn that some of those officers or many of those officers did respond. They are, after all, federal law enforcement officers. And in an incident like this, it appears that officers from all units of government responded.
And Cesar, could you talk specifically about the role of ICE here?
Yeah, so the governor did reference Homeland Security investigations, which is a component of ICE that is involved in the investigation. It's unclear to me to what extent they're involved in the investigation at this point. But the more concerning question for me is moving forward. What happens in the days and weeks and potentially even years ahead as law enforcement officials and community members try to unravel exactly what happened that led to Tuesday's massacre. And the 2019 shooting in the Walmart in El Paso is really something that poses a concern because there again we had a heavily Latino community in the state of Texas. And in that instance, we see that at least one individual who survived the El Paso shooting and was trying to cooperate was in fact cooperating with the local prosecutors who were putting together their case against the shooter. Was eventually deported, and deported as a result of a fairly ordinary traffic violation, a busted taillight, it turns out, and which led from a run-in with the local police to being handed off to Border Patrol and was soon out of the United States. There's absolutely no reason to believe that is impossible to happen in a community like Uvalde. Yes, most of the people who live in that community are U.S. citizens. Many of them have had their families in this area for generations. But this is still a Texas community. About 10% or 11% of the population of the city of Uvalde appears to have been born outside of the United States. There's no reason to doubt that there might be some individuals who were at the school, whether students or otherwise, whose immigration status in the United States is not at all solid, and who may benefit from the kind of visa that Congress has created specifically for victims of crime. And I hope that the many elected officials who are currently offering their thoughts and their prayers will soon, if not already, turn to also offering assistance in navigating what is always a complicated legal process to help individuals who may be affected by Tuesday shooting with tapping the legal resources, the immigration law resources that Congress has created.
We won't get into this right now, but there are serious questions about why authorities didn't move in faster as this man killed, this 18-year-old killed 19 kids and their two teachers. Parents were outside clamoring to get in, and it now looks like authorities were holding them back, that the man was inside for something like 40 minutes to an hour. But I wanted to to finally ask you, Cesar, about this story of what happens to immigrants who help. Here in New York, we had this horrible subway shooting, though no one died. New York Times had a piece. After New York's worst subway attack in decades, a Mexican woman who'd been on an ill-fated train gave police her cell phone to retrieve videos of the chaos. She was undocumented. The next day, Frank James walked by three men upgrading surveillance cameras at a hardware store in the East Village of Manhattan. They flagged down police officers. They were an undocumented Mexican immigrant, a Lebanese student, and an American-born Syrian who'd fled civil war and left his parents behind. The authorities have credited all four with helping to capture the shooter. And this is the key part of the Times piece. Police have credited immigrants, an undocumented Mexican immigrant, Lebanese student, American-born Syrian who fled civil war, with helping to capture the man in New York. They now seek relief from the U.S. immigration system as they seek visas set aside for victims, witnesses, and informants who help law enforcement and are determining whether they can access alternatives like humanitarian parole or political asylum. And goes to what happened in El Paso. A woman who survived and helped the police was then deported. Your final comment.
Republicans in Texas have often led the way in describing migrants as outsiders who have no attachments, who have no commitment to the communities in which they reside. But I think what we see over and over again is that migrants are just as committed to the communities in which they live as the rest of us are. And so I hope that the governor and the attorney general of Texas, who have made their name in recent years by attacking migrants in Texas and across the United States, will really put their resources, their offices' resources behind helping to make sure that any and all individuals who have some useful information are actually protected legally by the very laws that Congress has enacted specifically to protect survivors of crime like murder, like felonious assault, both of which are high on my list of possibilities for exactly the kind of to describe exactly the kind of situation like occurred here. And if they don't come through, then it's up to federal law enforcement agencies like the FBI, like the Department of Homeland Security, both of which are authorized to also assist individuals through what is called the U visa process. And I hope that the Biden administration and Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas will take seriously that responsibility and make sure to step in if the state of Texas does not.
Cesar Cuauhtemoc García Hernández, want to thank you for being with us, professor of law at Ohio State University. Coming up, we speak to Patrick Cockburn about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Stay with us.
Всі вони, хто стояв на твоєму шляху, змиті дощем, опинившись позаду, у цім багні я ніяк не збагну. Де перемога, де зрада?
Ivy by the Ukrainian folk and country singer Sasha Boul. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. In Ukraine, fierce fighting continues to rage around the besieged industrial city of Severodonetsk, where sustained Russian artillery attacks this week have killed at least six civilians. Russian forces are also advancing on the city of Lyman in the southeastern Donetsk region. The war began 3 months ago this week, but there appears to be little progress on peace talks. We're joined now by Patrick Cockburn, award-winning journalist and columnist. He's the former Moscow correspondent for The Independent. Recent piece for Counterpunch is headlined, London and Washington are being propelled by hubris, just as Putin was. Patrick, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain.
Well, this war began with a tremendous act of hubris, of arrogance by Vladimir Putin. He thought that his newly equipped army, which wasn't that big, in fact, would be greeted with by the Ukrainian population, that the Ukrainian government would collapse, that the Ukrainian army would surrender. And we all know that exactly the opposite happened. I mean, this was a ludicrous gamble, never likely to succeed. But now what's so worrying is that I think you see hubris on the other side with the US, with Britain, other NATO states, and to somewhat to a lesser degree, the Ukrainian government, also in a triumphalist mood. They are gloating over the very real Russian defeats in northern Ukraine. And the policy objective has changed from defending Ukraine to a rather sort of messy objective, which sometimes is regime change in Moscow, or it's fighting until Crimea is returned, not to the situation before 24th of February when the war began, but the situation before 2014. The Russians will never give this up, so this is really an endless war. So what worries me is that I spent a lot of time in Syria and wars in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq. It's becoming very like more and more like the Syrian situation, that Ukraine is becoming the arena for a war between Russia and, in the distance, the US, the NATO powers. This war, there's no reason this war should end. And while this war goes on, the whole country gets devastated. The infrastructure gets destroyed. Millions of refugees flee. This is more and more like Syria was after 2011. But I think this sort of vague triumphalism is obscuring just how dangerous and how bad the situation has become.
Oh, Patrick, could you talk about, your assessment seems, like others, very similar, in fact, to what Kissinger said, quote, pursuing the war beyond that point, that is to say, the point of attempting to go to the status quo ante, that should not be an attempt, that it would not be about the freedom of Ukraine, but a new war against Russia itself. But could you explain what incentive, given that Ukraine was in fact invaded, what incentive do the Ukrainians have to give up? And equally, what incentive does Russia have, having carried out, as you say, this audacious invasion?
I don't think anybody's suggesting for a moment that the Ukrainians give up in the sense of surrender. I think that, they've heroically defended their independence. The Russian invasion really failed in the first few days. The question is, rather, do you say that we should return to the status quo ante with guarantees to Ukraine? Was Russia still going to be there? We did long-term guarantees for Ukraine. And to bring this war to an end with an independent Ukraine capable of defending itself. Once you go beyond that, you actually are acting against, to my mind, the interests of Ukraine. And you put Ukraine in the position of an all-out war with Russia, which is a greater power, is not going to go away. And that's why I think you'll end up with a war very similar to the wars one's witnessed in the Middle East, from Libya to Afghanistan, in which the country, which is each country has in turn been sort of devastated and has never recovered.
Patrick, what about the status of possible negotiations, with Zelensky saying earlier this week that he would only negotiate with Putin?
Well, if there are negotiations, it will probably end up like that. I mean, there were serious negotiations at the somewhat over a month ago in Turkey, in which the Ukrainians made a very serious offers that the whole issue of the Ukraine should be pushed forward. I think it was 15 years would not have to be resolved immediately. That means they don't have to accept they've lost Crimea. The whole issue of Crimea should be pushed forward 15 years. So that means they don't have to discuss or give up Crimea, and the Russians don't have to say we'll never leave. So there is room for negotiations there, but one has to say the Ukrainians are not being offered that at the moment, and both sides think they can still make gains on the ground, that the battlefield still has things to offer them.
Finally, Patrick Coburn, do you think that the weapons flow from the U.S. and the West to Ukraine is exacerbating, prolonging the war?
Well, the Ukrainians need weapons. Then people trying to distinguish between defensive weapons and offensive weapons. That there isn't a great dividing line between the two. Ukrainians should clearly be armed. But then one gets to the situation, what will happen if there are lots of anti-ship missiles firing at the Russians at the Black Sea, in the Black Sea?
We have 10 seconds.
The problem is that this war is becoming another endless war, like we've seen in Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria and elsewhere, and all over the world. And most wars don't end with a decisive victory. But if it becomes an endless war, then Ukraine will be devastated.
We're going to have to leave it there. Patrick Coburn, award-winning journalist and columnist. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.